Humility is one of the most important qualities which you must have. Because if you are humble, if you make people realize that you are no threat to them, then people will embrace you.
Welcome to the Fidelis Leadership Podcast, a place of learning for those who aspire to leadership excellence. Here's our host, Mike Etor.
Colonel Mickey Addison, United States Air Force, retired as a leadership speaker, blogger, and author, and is a frequent contributor to military and business publications. Mickey is passionate about inspiring people to be their best and leading organizations to high levels of performance. I'm delighted that Mickey has agreed to join us today to share his experiences and insights. Mickey, welcome to the Fidelis Leadership Podcast.
Oh, hey, thanks, Mike. I'm really glad to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
No, I was thrilled when you said yes. I've been on your mailing list for a few years, all sorts of good leadership stuff in those emails, some good nuggets. The intro was obviously very brief. You got a rich background. Can you give us another minute or two of what we need to know about Mickey Addison?
Yeah, absolutely. So grew up here in Texas, where I live today. I live in New Braunfels, Texas, and spent 30 years in the Air Force, 87 to 97. I'm a 87 to 2017. And I'm graduated from Texas A&M, married my college sweetheart. We have two kids. They're all grown now, both of them. I traveled the world in the Air Force. I was an engineer officer, and I had a couple of Middle East deployments, a couple of Pentagon assignments. I still served at every level of staff from Office Secretary of Defense all the way down to the base level. Five commands. I'm very honored to have commanded five times in our Air Force, command airmen. And so now I'm a consultant for one of the big five consulting companies. And I also write and speak on leadership, which is my passion. I really feel like after spending so much time leading people, not just military people, but you know, civilians and contractors and the teams that we have in our engineering profession in uniform, that I learned a lot about leadership. And so I don't want to take that to the grave with me. I want to pass that on to other people, and if they can benefit from that and learn how to lead better and make their people happier and their organizations more productive, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I always start off the interview with a couple standard questions. And the first one is, if you were approached, Mickey, and asked to give your leadership philosophy in 2, 3, 4 sentences, a real short executive summary, what would you say?
Yeah, so it's five things, and it's the same five things that I have used since I was a young officer. It's integrity, respect, teamwork, leaders lead, and little things matter. So integrity has to be the hallmark of who we are as leaders and as people. And you know, the word comes from the Latin ingrititatem, which means to be of one mind, one body, integrated, is the same root. So you have to be the same person on Monday morning that you were on Sunday morning. Integrity, respect, you know, good leaders both show respect, demand respect, and cultivate an atmosphere where everyone within the organization feels respected, like they can bring their authentic self to work. Teamwork, everything we do both in the military and the private sector is done as part of a team. Leaders lead is all about, if you're given authority as a leader, to use it. Don't delegate up and don't delegate down. You're being paid as a leader to exercise authority and judgment. There's lots of ways to do that, but you shouldn't be passing your responsibilities to other people. And then the last thing is, little things matter. Not every little thing matters. And what you choose to pay attention to as a leader depends a lot on the organization that you're in and the level that you're at. But little things add up to big things. And I always tell the story when I give that talk about one of the first things I did when taking over a unit or visiting a part of one of the units when I was a leader or a commander was check the bulletin boards. And if the bulletin board was out of date, you know, the chaplain PCS'd, or you know, was transferred off the base three chaplains ago, or the EEOC letter is faded and unreadable, or the union plaque has fallen over, then you got to wonder what else is going wrong inside that organization. So you choose the indicators that give you an idea of what the health of the organization is, and then track on.
Yeah, solid comments. I want to ask you the timeless question, Mickey. Leaders, born or made?
And the answer is yes. So I do think there are some people that are just naturally, genetically predisposed to stepping in front. But those people, I think, are generally rare. I do think that you have to have a desire to be a leader, but I think the classic idea is that a leader is an extrovert. And I don't think all leaders are extroverts. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of leaders are introverts, meaning they get their energy, they give energy when they're with people. That means they don't like people. That means that they, you know, an extrovert gets energy from being around people. An introvert drains their batteries when they're forced to interact too much. But I do think that you, no matter whether you're predisposed genetically to be the person who's stepping in front, or whether you're just placed there because that's where your career path takes you, you do have to do the work of learning how to do it. And I look back at, you know, when I was a squadron commander as a young captain, and then I look and see, and I saw how, you reflect on how I led then, and then I look ahead to when I was a colonel, you know, with a very senior group around me, and look how I led then, and I realized I did grow over that 25 years. So leaders really do, you, I think you're, there's a part of you that's made, and then you do have to want to, and some people have naturally skilled at it, but I think generally speaking, leaders are made, not born.
Yeah, I agree with that. Then, by the way, I think that's every speaker that I've interviewed has basically said that as well. Mm-hmm. Very small slice with natural aptitude. Most people have to wake up, desire to be a leader, and work at it. Mm-hmm. And they often eclipse the guy or gal with natural aptitude who isn't working as hard.
That's right. Yeah,
One claim that I make in my coaching practice, Mickey, is relative to what we've just been discussing, is the term world class. I believe that anyone with the desire and willingness to put in the work, the repetitions and study, I believe that anyone can become a world class leader. Doesn't necessarily mean you're in a world class organization, mm-hmm. but I think you can become a world class leader, and all that implies. What's your thoughts on that statement?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it goes back to doing the work that we just talked about, you know, so you put the effort in, and again, there's a talent aspect. I don't want to downplay that. Some people are no matter how hard they try, I will never be wide receiver for the Dallas Cowboys, no matter how hard I try or work at it. Even though I know how to play football, but I'm never going to play at that level. So there are some folks I think that will struggle to get to the world-class level. But in general, so I have a model, a leadership model that I use called the Leader Sync model. And I use it when speaking and writing about project management. And it's integrating the needs of the institution that you work for, the needs of the mission or the project that you're working on, and the needs of the team that you have that you're leading. And if you think of those as a Venn diagram and three overlapping circles, the more you make those circles overlap, the bigger you get that middle section to overlap, the higher performing the team's going to be. And what that translates into is understanding who you work for and what, because all of us work for somebody, even when we work for ourselves, we're still working for somebody. And so understanding the institution or the person or the group, or even if it's yourself that you serve, and what their needs are, and meeting those. Understanding the needs of the mission means knowing what it is that you're trying to accomplish. It does no good if your boss is happy with you because you're a great guy, mm-hmm. if you don't actually get anything done. You do actually have to do the work. And that's where a lot of people live, because it's easy. I can put that kind of information in a spreadsheet, and I can count numbers, and I don't have to talk to a human being. I can just work on project management. And then the last part is the people. You know, you can get to the finish line with any team. Any leader can push somebody to the end. We've all seen leaders in our military civilian careers that have gotten to the finish line. But, you know, if you're screeching in on four bald tires and a blown head of your metaphorical engine, and nobody wants to work with you or anybody else in that project again, and they're all looking for new work, well, then, you know, that's not a success. What you want to do is get to the end where everybody is excited about the next project.
Yeah, agreed. I want to ask, you've observed so many leaders in both of your careers and served as a mentor and coach to many. Of the very, very best, the top slice, the exceptional ones, Mickey, do you ever notice that there's a list of traits or characteristics that most of the very best share in common?
Yeah, I really have. So, when I had a privilege to attend National Defense University, it's now called the college that I went to in NDU was then called the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, but now called the Eisenhower School for National Resource Strategy. And so we had a parade of senior leaders that came and talked to us about a variety of topics. Happened to be there during the financial crash, so economics was obviously on the top. But when they all, no matter what they talked about, whether they came and gave a technical talk or a leadership talk, they all talked about what their philosophy is. And I noticed a theme. And the theme was they were all readers. All of them had were constantly learning. They were lifelong learners and readers. They were generally early risers. Most of them, you know, said that they were up fairly early. And they all took time to either pray or meditate first thing in the morning and make time to clear their head and connect with the divine. So I think, you know, when I look at habits, I think those are key. And then there's other ones. You know, good leaders, I think, know how to organize their time and prioritize their time, because everyone's demanding time of a leader. And being able to prioritize what's right, you know, what you really need to be working on is really important. I think we've all seen leaders, both in the corporate world and in, you know, in the military, where time was not a priority. You know, we weren't working on the most important thing. Let me say that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the other things I think is, you know, when I get asked this question often about, you know, what's the most important quality of a leader, I would say it's love. And that people go, love, that's kind of, what do you mean? Well, so love is different than like. Love is investing yourself in somebody else. And the Greeks use three different words. You know, eros obviously is romantic love. Philios is brotherly love. And then agape is total self-giving love. And certainly you're not having eros as a leader in the corporate or military world with your folks. But there's a certain amount of brotherly or sisterly and self-giving that goes along with that. Because ultimately leadership is about service. You're in the service of the people that you are leading, because your job is to clear barriers. It is to lift them up. It is to look for when they're stumbling and keep them from hurting, you know, and if somebody's working too hard, you know, it's maybe Sue or Bob's performance has fallen off. Well, you know, you should be asking yourself why, not don't, you know, the first thing should not be, let's go punish Sue or Bob because their performance fall off. You need to go find out why that is. And having genuine care and concern for their well-being. It doesn't mean you have to like everybody. There's some people you're just not going to get along with because you're different for whatever reason. But you do have to, you know, be in the service of the people that you're leading.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask your thoughts on this one, Vicki. Let's say in your current company, let's say 3 years ago, a cohort of young leaders was promoted. First, you know, entry-level leaders. And then let's fast forward 20 years. And of those 10 managers, team leaders that got promoted in 2017, now fast forward 20 years, and three of them are actually C-level executives, and two or three of them are senior vice presidents or vice presidents, and the rest of them are maybe one level higher than entry level. Mm-hmm. What is it? And it was all else being equal at the beginning, all the same kind of degrees, same kind of IQ, same kind of everything was equal, even though we know that often isn't the case. But
right.
I'm trying to make a point here is, what is it that makes people rise above their peers? Are there certain things they do, actions they take, habits they have? What makes them rise to the top, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think you have to set aside, obviously, the misbehavior piece, right?
Right.
Because there's always nepotism and, you know, things like that. So if you set that aside for a moment, and I know we're going to talk about race, so let's set that aside for a minute for later on in the conversation.
Yep.
You know, racism, sexism, those kind of things. But, you know, so if you have the perfect meritocracy, then, you know, why would some people rise given that they started at the same level and have basically the same skills? And I think that the ones that rise tend to be more invested in those around them and in understanding what their bosses and their bosses' priorities. So I used to tell my young squadron commanders and my young flight commanders, hey, look, you need to be working your bosses' priorities. And so what does that mean? So in the military, that means my boss's commander understanding what he or she needs so that I can make that happen for my boss, right? And that makes all of us successful. But I think there's another element to that as well, and that is the networking piece and building networks laterally, that the best leaders are really connected. And they never seek to take a withdrawal without making lots of deposits first.
Yeah,
I get really frustrated with people who connect with me on LinkedIn. And they go, you know, I know what's coming when I see the connection. It's, hi, Mickey, I see we're in the same space and I would like to connect, yeah. You know, and you look at the title and it's, you know, I help self-made people do, you know, no, it's not whatever. So, you know, I occasionally will take it, depending on how the thing is written, I will occasionally accept that connection. And then the next email is, hey, can you buy something from me? So we haven't made any, he or she hasn't made any investment in the relationship, and they already want to make a withdrawal. And I got that idea, by the way, from a guy named Scott Stratton, who writes a book called Unmarketing. He's got a whole series, he's got a great podcast. But he writes about that, you know, marketing and sales and business is more about people and relationships. And I'm stealing his line. You cannot make a withdrawal before you make a deposit.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very wise. I wanted to ask you, relative to that group that rises to the top, do you think that the traits or habits of being a lifelong learner and you know, self-investing in their own development play a role in it? I mean, the company's only going to do so much for them. Do you think that most of the best that rise to the top went above and beyond and did stuff in their off time?
Yeah, I do. And are curious about the organization. So, you know, so I was an engineer. I was a support officer of the Air Force, but I always surprised people. And it was fun to watch the faces change when I could speak, you know, in operational terms about delivering air power, because I understood it, at least at the, you know, at the amateur practitioner level.
Right.
But I understood how air power is produced. And that was important to me for two reasons. First of all, I was an Air Force officer. I thought it ought to be how we produce combat power in the Air Force should be important to me because I'm an Air Force officer. But the other part of it was, it kind of goes to the idea of, you know, when I got my pilot's license, I was happened to have lunch with my wing commander, and I told him, hey, sir, I'm getting my pilot's license. He goes, that's great. He goes, I told him, I think that'll make me a better engineer. He says, I think it will too. He says, it's like having a greenskeeper who doesn't play golf.
Yeah.
Right? So it's kind of the same idea. You know, you get invested in understanding and you're curious about how things work. And through doing that, not even in a self-serving way, you're able to see and make connections about how you can add value to your organization. And that's regardless of military or civilian, you know, thing. I talk about balance. If you just give me 30 more seconds, in my book, The 5 B's, I talk about be balanced. And I use three aspects of the human being, the physical, mental, and spiritual. And I think you have to have those three things. You have to care and feed for those three aspects of your human person. You certainly can't be healthy. You can't be a good leader if you're not healthy physically. You have to be, and it doesn't mean everybody has to be a CrossFit, you know, games athlete, but everybody right. needs to be, you know, you need to sleep enough, eat the right stuff most of the time. And the same thing with your mental, lifelong learning. And the spiritual case, for some people, that's practicing your faith. It is for me. But for others, it just goes sitting on top of a mountain and watching the sunrise or doing something. Because there's, as Yoda says, you know, we are more than just this crude matter. You have to feed your human spirit.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. What you just referred to, you know, the physical, spiritual, mental, I refer to that as the whole body concept, the whole person concept. Mm-hmm. And my experience in the executive ranks, both as an executive in a publicly traded company, dealing with peers, my experience was I rarely ran into a high achieving executive that suffered from self-inflicted physical or mental problems. Mm-hmm. They didn't allow themselves to drink to excess. They did not allow themselves to get overly, you know, overweight. And like I said, they didn't have to be marathoners. They're not going right. to body, but they, in fact, every high achieving executive I've ever known or worked with was an early riser, was very temperate in his habits with alcohol, and exercise daily, even if that mm-hmm. meant they walked for a half hour. Now, some mm-hmm. were into hardcore, you know, lifting and running and all that, but others right, it was, right. no, I'm going to go walk, and that's when I get my best thoughts. So mm-hmm. I think you're onto something there. I obviously endorse that. I wanted to talk, Mickey, we're going through a real sentinel period, certainly in our lifetimes, with this COVID-19. It's the black swan event that we've always read about. I mean, mm-hmm. it crushed a lot of the world, literally in deaths, unfortunately, but certainly with commerce and trade and politics and all of that. Mm-hmm. And so it's been going on a few months. What are you seeing? You got a good vantage point. What are you seeing the smart guys, you know, the smart leaders, smart men and women, what are they doing after the initial shock? Some of them appear to be actually capitalizing on this friction. It's like initial mm-hmm. setback and, okay, I've recovered from that punch and we're actually moving again. What do you see most of the smart ones doing?
Yeah, so obviously there's the pivot to virtual. So a lot of us who have office jobs, you know, where our office is our laptop, you know, that we're able to pivot very quickly to virtual. And some of the, a lot of the nonprofits and professional organizations the same. So I often present at, I'm a member, a life member of the Society of American Military Engineers, and they have two big conferences a year, the Joint Engineer Training Conference in the spring and the, which we just had in May, and then the Small Business Conference in the fall. And, you know, it was obviously going to be, it was going to be canceled this year, but they were, they got feedback. We want to do this virtually. They, the staff went and figured out how to do it, and they pivoted to a virtual conference. And actually, I think it was, other than missing, seeing my friends in person, you know, that we see, you know, twice a year at this, at these things, it was a great event. And so that's indicative of a lot of companies, you know, the military is learning that teleworking is not a bad word. So they're exploring a lot of that. So the same thing with, you know, the corporate America is learning that, you know, maybe they don't need to own these buildings. You know, maybe they can lease, maybe they can reduce their footprint. Maybe it's okay if they don't have everybody in the office all the time in the cubicle farm, and that their employees are happier and they get just, they're just as productive. So those have been good. I do think, you know, I live in a town that depends on tourism a lot. You know, New Braunfels is right here on the Guadalupe River, and so in the Comal River. And so we get a lot of summer tourists, and you know, it's right on the edge of the Austin music scene. So we get a lot of live music. And so people who depend on either going somewhere to make their money, who can't work from home, you know, you can't work from, you can't stock a grocery store shelf or work at a gas station or, you know, from home, or certainly not work in the healthcare industry. So those, they're struggling, you know, and my heart breaks for those folks who had business. I mean, I don't know how many businesses have had gone under.
Yeah.
But they didn't do anything wrong. You know, they just, they just got told to shut themselves down. So it's hard to, although I have seen other companies in like the food service industry, I think it's been able to pivot a little bit. Artists are learning how to stream things from home. There's a really cool platform called Stage It where you can have a virtual concert. They've been putting out a lot of content, artists, music, some musicians especially, have put out a lot of content over the internet. So I think the jury's out as to whether that's going to be good or bad for the music industry. But
yeah,
but I think there's a, the ability, so to answer your question without giving any more examples, I think the ability to break out of the silo of this is what I'm thinking, and this is the way we've done it, into how can I do it, has been the mark of successful companies.
Yeah, I agree. Let me give you an example. Two examples. I know an executive on a Fortune 50 company. I won't tell you the company, obviously, but they have tens of thousands of square feet in downtown Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And he said, Mike, you know, we were definitely anti-remote. How do, you know, we want everybody in here. We got all this square footage. And he said, now that everybody's remote, Mike, the bottom line is we're pulling it off. And I can assure you that when we do the next lease, it will not be for 35,000 square feet in downtown Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Now, whether that excess square footage turns into housing or whatever. So there's going to be opportunities everywhere. Then I know a fellow that runs a very upscale restaurant. And he said, you know, Mike, we were always too highfalutin to consider takeout food. And legally, we were not permitted to send mixed drinks or alcohol mm-hmm. with a takeout order. Mm-hmm. And he said, we were faced with a choice of either going takeout or not have a business. And the state allowed us temporarily to do this, you know, with the mm-hmm. mixed drinks. He said, we're making so much money now that we will never go away from takeout. We're still mm-hmm. going to be a fine dining restaurant, but we realize right. there's people that want fine dining that just would rather not have to get dressed up. And we got with the state, he's on a panel that's looking at this alcohol issue. And he proposed, let us do this for another year, even if COVID goes away. Mm-hmm. And my theory is, I mean, we have to proof people and make sure we're sending it to adults. But my theory is DUIs and alcohol related crashes will go down.
Yeah,
and,
maybe.
And they were all over that. And that state extended this for another year. Anecdotally, or I guess empirically, the data shows improvement, but then again, everybody's been locked up. So it's when things get to normal again, will sending that two or three martinis to the guy in his house, will that prevent him from having that third one at the bar and then running off the road and killing an innocent family and all of that? So classic cases of friction and disruption leading to innovation and opportunity. I wanted to talk to you about this. Obviously, I mean, I know you're all over this. You watch the news. I think our country is in probably, I think, Mickey, I'm 63 going on 64. I think this might be the most divisive period in the United States society-wise during my life. I mean, I was a young boy. I remember the civil rights movement. So I guess maybe this is similar to the civil rights movement, but I was too young to remember it and didn't have social media. But of course, you know, the recent murder or execution, if you will, of George Floyd, which is, you know, broadcast on national TV, led to protests and then unfortunately riots and all of that. The bottom line is America is being dragged, I think, into the next level of the discussion on race relations. And so my question to you is, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but you know, everybody's looking at CEOs and you see all these memes on LinkedIn, like we are committing $300 million to the NAACP. Now that's all good. I'm not mocking that.
Right.
But we don't have those guys on this podcast. We have team leaders and supervisors and foremen. Any advice for them, what they can do with their five-man team, 25-person department to ensure that it is the purest meritocracy possible, that it really is colorblind, that it really is something where men and women of all orientations, all colors, all ethnicities really are respected and progress on merit?
Right. Yeah, so I think leaders have to do two things. And first of all, I'm going to preface this with, I am not an expert. We do have experts in diversity and inclusion, and I would really encourage people to seek that those out. Read a lot of books. You know, leaders, this is a time to get educated and to listen. So the first advice I would give to leaders is, you know, in a medium and small company or organization, is first of all, make it very clear to everybody explicitly what is acceptable behavior and what is not. And I think, you know, you can't just put out an email that says, you know, read the company handbook, right? You have to be able to, making sure that you are being just and fair and respectful and creating that environment is not a legal requirement. Yeah, we all have laws, you know, and you got to obey the law, but that if you're just obeying the law, you're failing. That's not what this is about. You should be making it very clear as a leader what you mean when you say we are going to respect each other. And then you have to be able to have the hard conversations and call people out when they fail to live up to that standard. And I don't mean, you know, calling people names and shouting and raising your voice. You know, most of the time that's not required. And there's a difference between a mistake and a crime. So we talk about sexual harassment, for example. There's a difference between a mistake and a crime, and leaders need to be able to know the difference.
Yeah.
Mistakes are okay. You apologize and move on. Crimes are not okay. Call the authorities. So with all that as a preface, I think, for, you know, making sure that you make your expectations on how everybody is to interact with each other, the respect that they required, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable in the workplace, I think is first. And then equally as important, but a close second, is you have to be listen and engage in the conversation, especially now. There are so many people who feel like they have not been heard, that they have been saying over and over and over again for decades, there is still gross racism in this country, and we are turning a blind eye to it as a country because we think we're past it, because we elected President Obama, or because we passed this law or that law. And there are still people. And when you start hearing the stories, you know, when Senator Tim Scott, you know, how many Black senators are in the United States Senate?
Right.
It's just a handful. So when Senator Tim Scott says he stopped not once, not twice, but seven times on the way to his office, Capitol Police really don't know who Senator Scott is? Seriously?
Yeah.
Or I don't know if it's Capitol Police that stopped him, but whoever stopped him. And when the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force, General C.Q. Brown, who's our incoming Chief of Staff, who will take over here sometime in the next couple of months from General Goldfein, who was Black, when he talks about his experience as an African-American man, and when the current Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, the highest ranking enlisted non-commissioned officer in the Air Force, talks about his experience, and you hear the same stories over and over again from men and women of all walks of life. It's not just, you know, this social class or that education or whatever. When you hear it over and over again, then you have to sit up and listen and recognize that, no, this isn't over. And it breaks my heart that the country that I've given my life to still struggles with this. But what gives me hope is that people seem to be listening as a country. And I think this is a sea change in our country. I think we'll see real structural change in our country. And so, you know, as we talked about it in our preview talk just before we turn on the recording, about how, you know, it's the staff NCOs, it's the middle managers, first line leaders who get it done. And that's true in the civilian world as well. You know, it is the small unit leader who translates the big ideas that the CEO or the whoever into actionable things. And then circling back to something I said earlier, you know, you got to love people. Well, that's part of it. You got to see when somebody's hurting. Hey, how you doing? Are you okay? You know, is this affecting you? And you got to care enough to ask those questions and engage with them and then take action. Yeah. You know, I think that's what I hope comes out of this. I hope that I agree with you. I think we are probably in the most turmoil we've been, at least since 1968 and maybe since 1850. And, you know, with both of those struggles, although, as I mentioned, you know, the Civil War was pretty bloody way to learn a lesson.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hope, you know, I hope and pray that we never see anything like that again. But, you know, some good things came out of the revolutions of 1968, and, you know, a greater awareness of the civil rights movement in 1964, a greater awareness of our shared humanity. And so what I hope comes out of this is, one, people feel like, you know, African-Americans in our country feel like they've finally been heard and are being listened to, and their concerns being taken seriously. And then I hope we act. I hope we act as a country. And if we don't change the laws, if we don't think the laws need changing, then at least we change our behavior. And that comes, you know, it comes down to every one of us, leader and no leader. You know, when you hear somebody call somebody a name that's inappropriate, you know, sexist or racist or what, you call them out, you go, hey, that is not acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, being aware of what symbols and pictures and images we have in our workplace, and whether they are offensive in nature. It doesn't mean we have to walk on eggshells. It doesn't mean we have to agree with everybody's political and religious beliefs, but it does mean we have to be respectful of each other.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, a couple of thoughts on that. I very well spoken, Mickey. You know, I was raised by great parents, never heard any racial terms or biases in my family. And so I was a typical white guy, like, no, I'm not a racist. Everything is cool, until I started meeting my friends and they started telling me about their experience, you know, minorities from the deep South or the ghetto or whatever. And the advice I have for you, I think we have a lot of younger leaders on here, Mickey, is look, just because you're not guilty of it doesn't mean other people aren't. And just because you wouldn't personally do something to somebody doesn't mean that some people that you know haven't had pretty terrible experiences. Mm-hmm. When I was an infantry company commander, my wife and I were going to buy a house. We applied for a mortgage. At the same time, one of my staff NCOs applied for a mortgage, and he was Black. And he went to the same bank. And he came to me and he said, hey, sir, do you mind if I ask, what kind of questions did they ask you? The bottom line is they asked him several questions that they didn't ask me. And it was all like, essentially, are you sure you can afford this? Are you going to just run away from this mortgage or whatever? I couldn't believe it. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. So I actually took steps and we reported that bank and all of that. But that was really a first wake up call for me. Like, two people, same unit, same bank, same level of home loan and all of that. And mine was approved almost immediately.
Yeah. And probably roughly the same income too. If he's a staff sergeant and you're
we're probably within $5,000 or $8,000 of each other. So that was a real wake up call for me. So I just think I wanted to throw that to, I think most of our audience, Mickey, is younger And I think between what you're saying, I'm saying, and what some of the other guests are saying, just hope that some of our folks out there at every level are just keeping an open mind and taking action. Because to your earlier point, I'm really not sure the laws have to change. We've got pretty good laws, but laws cannot control human thought and human action unless someone overtly crosses the line. Right. You know, it's like, you know, we come from military backgrounds. You know, someone can be pretty respectful to a senior officer.
Right. But the sentence starts with all due respect. It is not with all due respect.
Yeah. You know, you can get pretty surly and just come one step short of an NJP.
Yeah, but
for all intents and purposes, you've just fired that guy up and insulted him or whatever. So I appreciate your comments on this. Anything else on the issue?
Yeah, I got one story that I want to tell. I think this is an actionable thing that we can leaders can take with them. So in the Air Force at the base level, they do a thing called a status of discipline meeting. And so for those of your listeners that don't have military backgrounds, in the military, the commander can take what's called non-judicial punishment. And in those cases, things that don't go to court-martial. And so in those cases, the commander has pretty broad authority. He acts both as prosecutor and as the judge. And so you bring the person in, you read them the charge, the violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and then the person decides to plead guilty or they can request trial by court-martial. And then you assign punishment. And it can be everything from a reprimand to you can demote them. You can't put them in confinement, but you can give them extra duty. And your rank also depends on the rank of the person being disciplined. So every quarter, the squadron commanders get together and the judge advocate general, the JAG for the wing, will brief the statistics. And then you talk about the cases that came up during the quarter. And the point of that is to make sure that everybody is pretty much, although every case is different and you treat every case individually, there's nobody given, a summary execution for a DUI and the other person's given a reprimand, right?
Right, right.
The first part of that briefing though are the statistics. And one of the required briefing statistics was UCMJ rates by sex and by race. And the white male or the black male rates of punishment were almost always higher and usually close to twice what the white male rate was. And we all looked around the room at each other. Whenever those came up, we all looked around each other and said, which one of you SOBs is the racist? And of course, those are Air Force-wide statistics, not just at our base. We looked at the base ones too. And that was the wrong question. And here's the lesson for your people, your listeners. That which one of those fellow squadron commanders was the racist was the wrong question to be asking. What we should have been asking is how those cases got to our desk in the first place. So, did the black airman get a reprimand and get paper immediately the first time he's a couple of minutes late for work and the white airman skate by?
Yeah.
Or something like that. So, I am confident that I handled every case that came to my desk fairly and I gave the same punishment to every airman for the same offense as long as there weren't extenuating circumstances. But the question I should have been asking myself is how did it get to my desk in the first place? And I think that's what leaders can do. And it doesn't just mean discipline. It can be promotions. It can be all kinds of things. When you see a list of people, of names, they've come to your desk for some kind of action, you need to ask yourself, how did these names get here? What criteria were used? And is everybody who's on this list supposed to be here? And everybody who's on the list, is everybody on the list supposed to be here? And who's missing? And why? And when you start asking those questions, I think we can start breaking down some of the barriers that have just developed over years. Exactly the kinds of things that you just talked about, which is, you can come pretty close to the line of the letter of the law and be having a moral decision or action. So
yeah, that's a good story, a good analogy. And my follow on to that for the listeners is, if you were accused as a leader, if you were accused of being completely unbiased and fair and equitable in all of your sense of discipline and justice to include, hey, okay, just don't do that again. Those kind of little things, those little nods like, okay, this third day in a row, you've had a flat tire. I mean, let's go, if you're accused of it, is there enough proof to convict you, so to speak?
I'm being
a bit of a smart ass, but it's, you're onto something big. Why do some people get the okay, come on over here. I'm not going to put paper on you right now, but this is not good. You need to tighten up and do this. And why do others don't get that talk? They've not done anything wrong before. It's the first time they've stepped across the line, but they're getting paper, which for you civilians means you're getting something official put into your record. And so when you peel that back, I think all the services and most companies would probably find statistics that they're not proud of.
Yeah. And I think we also, the other part of it is, you know, that's the fairness piece. I think there's a diversity and inclusion piece. And I'll be honest, I used to poo-poo this when I was in uniform, because I don't want to poo-poo it like it's not important, but just like, hey, we're doing that, right? Of course we are. You know, the enlisted guys take a test to get promoted. That's, you know, fun. But if you look around the room and everybody looks like you, you got to ask why. There may be a reason. There may be a good reason. Maybe you live in a community where everybody looks like you, and so that's who you hire. Maybe. I mean, I would think that was pretty rare. But
right.
But at the same time, you know, when I used to kind of not understand what people would say, diversity is our strength. It's like, I don't know what that means. Well, here's what I think it means. Here's what it means to me. It's not that I have two of these and one of those and, you know, somebody with this kind of name or that kind of background. For me, what diversity is our strength means is I have diversity of thought. Because when you look around the room and everybody has the same similar background and everybody has a similar, you know, career path and everybody has a similar family situation, you know, and speaks the same language and went to the same schools, you're going to get the same answers over and over again to your problems. And so when you bring in people, and that means as a leader reaching in and pulling people up, because some people won't step up until you invite them in. You have to invite these people in and invite them to the table and make sure not that you're diverse for diversity's sake, but that you are getting the best possible answers and solutions that involve things you might not have thought of. And we're getting close on time, but just a real quick story. And it's a time when I failed, frankly. They brought to my young company grade officers brought me a solution to use solar powered lights for Operation Iraqi Freedom. We were building a taxiway and I insisted we did it with wires. Well, I had to go back to South Carolina to brief headquarters. And when I got back, they'd gone around me, gotten approval, and they had ordered the solar powered lights for the taxiway. And if we had done it my way, we wouldn't have finished the taxiway. And as it was, we were screwing the last taxiway light down to the taxiway as the first F-18s and F-16s were taken off for Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Wow.
So, you know, that's the power of diversity of thought and not being hemmed in by your own experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wanted to, we are running short on time. I have one more question for you. Knowing what you know now, Mickey, what would you tell the young Second Lieutenant Addison in his first leadership role? What would you tell? Because it'll correlate with these young leaders and managers out that are listening to this podcast.
I would say take the art and craft of leadership seriously. Don't take it for granted. And that's an overarching statement for all the things we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes. And that is how important it is to take care of yourself, how important it is to set a good example, how important it is to be deeply, deeply invested in serving the people that you're leading.
Yeah.
To be curious about what your organization does and how it works. Then being laser focused on making sure that you as a leader are creating an environment where you get the best of people and they want to be there, because that's when you're going to get a group of people who are very high performing.
Yeah. Mickey, how do our listeners find you, your books, and your company, your website?
Yeah. So the easiest thing to do is to go over to my website, mickeyaddison.com, mickeyaddison.com. And you can sign up for my newsletter. I don't know when this podcast is going to air, but my newsletter is on a bit of a hiatus over the summer. I'll be restarting in the fall, but you can sign up for my newsletter. You can get information about my books and you can contact me directly. Do that. You can also follow me on LinkedIn.
Great. Great. Well, I really thank you for your investment in time and sharing your insights. It's been a great episode. This is going to be a popular one. And I respectfully ask that you consider coming back again.
Oh, thanks, Mike. I'd love to. I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thank you so much, Mickey.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Please subscribe, rate, review, and recommend to your friends. Please visit our website at fidelisleadership.com and sign up for our leadership newsletter. Until next time, remember the words of the ancient Greek philosopher Pericles.
What you leave behind is not what is engraved in stone monuments, but is woven in the lives of others.